Accession number 4601, Reel 3.
Squadron Leader Sells, Reel 3.
Flying, wherever possible, was carried out during the morning hours or in the evening when it was cooler. The squadron's role was that of part of the peacekeeping force in Iraq. It was responsible for the area from Baghdad down through Iraq, down the Persian Gulf, past Bahrain as far as Masira Island. The aircraft used were, first of all, when I got there, Whoppertys, but for the main part of the time, Vincent, made by Vickers. 3-seat light bombers. Their major task was to keep the landing grounds between Baghdad and Masira Island in order, so each flight would take turns in going out and inspecting these landing grounds. They would be out for 3 to 5 days at a time, taking with them their rations and a pot of white paint, whitewash, which they use for marking the boundaries of the airfields, because most of these particular landing grounds were completely unoccupied. They were there for emergency only. Training was done locally. There was a particularly good training ground for photography, in that only 12 miles away was the Shat al-Arab, which is the junction of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. There was Basra itself. On the other side of the water was Abadan with its oil refineries. So that it was quite interesting to fly. Not only that, within easy striking distance were the biblical towns of Ur and Amara and Babylon, so that flying was not entirely boring, although all one saw normally would be desert. Whilst I was at Shaiba, I was there originally as a main station wireless operator, and it was my job to take my turn on watch throughout the 24 hours of the day. I would be communicating with Baghdad, with Karachi, with Ismailia in Egypt, and occasionally with UK. It was our job to take down all communications, both service and civil. Newspapers arrived only weekly, so we kept pace with the news from the rugby broadcasting station and took that down in Morse and published our own newspapers. So wireless operators had their uses, apart from in the air. On the ground, they took the football results and published those. We also had a direction-finding capability and were able to assist Imperial Airways on their flying route from Baghdad through Shaiba to Bahrain and Karachi. As a wireless operator air gunner, I was able to fly quite frequently, but since the officer in charge of my particular section was rather a stickler for routine, he insisted that I did most of my flying in my spare time so as not to interfere with the rosters on the main station. This wasn't difficult, except when I had to take my turn to go out on the landing ground inspections and I would be away for days. Another task that the squadron had to perform was an annual one when reinforcements were sent from Iraq and India to Singapore. And we made this annual pilgrimage to Singapore, flying from Shaiba down the Persian Gulf, across India, down through Thailand, Burma, to Singapore, and back. This was a magnificent 3 weeks holiday, which we all looked forward to. When I left Shaiba, I had learned to play hockey, a game I had never played before. I had learned to play tennis, a game I had never played before. I was able to play football better than I had before, although I was already an accomplished footballer. I learned to swim. I had seen the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I had seen Harun al-Rashid's palaces in Baghdad. I had seen Sinbad's home in Basra. I had seen India, the Taj Mahal. I had seen Ashwedagon in Rangoon, and I had seen the Tiger Balm Gardens in Singapore, all as a result of being with this squadron, number 84 squadron, at Shaiba. Another thing I had learned, which I don't greatly boast, is that when I arrived at Shaiba, I had my first drink of alcoholic beverage. When I left 2.5 years later, I was able to sit down with any man and consume my 8 pints without bother, because this was the main hobby. We had fortnightly dances in the Nafi, what we called bread and bread. Boy dance with boy, because we had no women.
Why bread?
Bread and bread instead of bread and butter. And we ran our own bingo, although it was not called bingo in those days. It was Housey Housey. The finest time, though, was at Christmas, when each bungalow was committed to decorating to a set theme centered around a bar. For approximately 3 weeks before Christmas, each bungalow would choose its own theme and decorate. For instance, we've had Aladdin's Cave, we had a Hell's Kitchen, which included a complete grave and a burial, with such characters down below as a harlot, Nero, Henry VIII, bad characters in Hell's Kitchen. One bungalow on particular occasion was a tube station in London with an actual train running in at the platform, made from a builder's wagon with an electric motor on it. No expense was spared, as long as there was a bar. And there would be a competition. The station commander and other officers would go around and inspect each one and give a prize. And, of course, sampling on each one. And for the 5 days of Christmas, the same thing happened with the airmen. They would visit each and every bar in turn.
What was the prize?
A barrel of beer. It was an occasion when the station still worked. There was little flying down, but other things went on, especially in the wireless section. We had to keep going. Drunk or sober, we had to keep that open. But, let's say, for 5 days, everybody let their hair down, and we had a wild old time. We had a cinema, the like of which I have never seen anywhere else. The screen was a collection of large white sheets hung on the rear wall of the dining room, an open-air cinema, where you took your own chair, or you got your batman or bearer to take the chair for you and position it, where along one side was a naffy table with food and drink for sale, where during the height of the film, perhaps Loretta Young would be having her fourth baby or something similar, you would hear a wild cry from the audience, "Ghazi, fetch me a steak sandwich and a bottle of beer." Something of that sort.
Ghazi being an Arab servant.
An Arab servant. And again, one particular occasion I remember was a scene where we had a terrific windstorm appear without warning, and the screen split down the middle. And there was one particular actress, she had her legs going in two directions at once as the screen split. You might hear, for instance, a frenzied actor at one time saying, "An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth," when out of the audience would come, "Oh yes, and a big balloon for two jam jars." It was a very informal cinema. But we saw some good films. Once a week, only.
You mentioned this heavy drinking at Shaiba. What were the rules about the consumption of alcohol regarding aircrew?
Left to the discretion of the person himself. There was no firm rule that one didn't drink before flying. So this was left entirely to the persons themselves. But I can assure you, there was never any occasion on which anybody flew in any alcoholic haze. In any case, once you got into those open cockpit airplanes and you got up at 10,000 feet with a temperature of 120, 130 degrees beating down on your head, you couldn't afford to be alcoholic. Just wasn't possible. Oh no. If they were flying, they stayed sober.
What were the differences in flying conditions in Iraq as compared with the UK?
You could rely on the weather. You knew exactly that in 3 months' time, if you chose a date, that day was going to be fine. You knew exactly when the bad weather was going to come. There was hardly ever any rain. It was almost unknown. The air was always clear. The sky was clear of cloud. Perfect flying conditions, except over the foothills, when you would get the heat rising from the foothills and you would get turbulence. The aircraft themselves were delightful. You could sit up on the top of the cockpit and gaze around as they cruised about 100 to 110 miles an hour, steadily and slowly. Landmarks were few and far between, but then the wind was stable, you've got no deviation from track, and you could fly from A to B without any problems. If you got lost, there was always the one and only railway line to follow. That's going north towards Baghdad. Or if we flew down the Persian Gulf, there was always the coastline to follow. Oh no, flying was much, much better than in England.
How did Iraqi conditions affect the operating of wireless equipment?
It did a great deal, and we had electrical disturbance. Not electrical storms, but sand whipped up by wind generates static electricity. And on occasion, you would get a great deal of interference and signals would be blotted out without warning.
And there was just nothing you could do about this, was there?
Nothing. Just close down until conditions cleared.
You mentioned earlier on these landing grounds which you had to go and inspect. Did they have any kind of guard there? Or any personnel there at all?
No, only on the major airfields. But the minor ones, no, they were just cleared strips of land, marked by stones in the landing direction. No runways, of course. You just had chosen the area and marked the best track on which to land. These were marked by stones, and it was our job to go down and make sure that the stones were in the right place and were suitably coated with whitewash so that they could be seen from the air. They were emergency landing grounds. But, of course, the major landing grounds like Kuwait, Bahrain, Sharjah, Muscat, they were manned. and well looked after.
Can you say something about what it was like to fly in the Wapiti and the Vincent?
The Wapiti, built by the Western Company with a Bristol engine, was probably the first of what we now know as the STOL, the short takeoff and landing aircraft, in that it could take off in a very short distance, it could land in a very short distance, and it could climb rapidly because they had a high wing to load ratio. Its speed, under 100 miles an hour, its range about 4 hours. It carried 3 people, a pilot, usually a fitter or rigger, and if it carried wireless, a wireless operator. It was used as a light bomber reconnaissance aircraft. It was replaced later by the Vickers Vincent, which was built entirely by Vickers, again, with a Bristol engine, 3 open cockpits. Its speed maximum, I would say, would be about 120 miles an hour. It carried a fair bomb load, maybe close to 1,000 pounds, with a range of about 6.5 hours. It had a counterpart in the Wildebeest, the Vickers Wildebeest, which merely took the axle out from between the landing wheels and replaced it with a torpedo.
Your role in Iraq was presumably the control of the country as regards law and order. Was the squadron at Shaiba ever called out whilst you were there to perform that role?
Only on one occasion, when we were called to the north of Iraq. If I can give some idea of the layout, Shaiba was the station in the south of Iraq with number 84 squadron, assisted by number 203 squadron with flying boats to cover the Persian Gulf. In Baghdad, in the Baghdad area, first at Hinadi and later at Habania, there were 2 or 3 other squadrons. And then farther north still, near the Kurdistan border, at a place called Mosul, were other squadrons. And it was in this area that trouble often broke out. I think it was mostly the Kurds that created the trouble, and we would have a show of force. Whilst I was there, we were never called upon to use guns, merely to fly low and pretend, and this would drive the tribesmen back.
Were you personally involved in that operation?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. I went up with 3 aircraft. 3 of us went up, flew up there. We were stationed at Mosul for about 4 days, I would think. And we went out 6 times, merely to fly over areas. We saw some tribesmen, but I wouldn't call them insurgent in any way at all. They seemed to be quite peaceful just to me. But we were told afterwards that they were armed and had been causing trouble in the villages.
Were you shot at?
No. No, not at all. No, I had that pleasure later in India, but not in Iraq.
We'll come on to India later. You mentioned the isolation of Shaiba. How did morale hold up there?
Astonishingly high. It's a remarkable thing. Man seems to be happier when he's suffering. We suffered mainly in terms, I suppose, of loneliness. But we were closer on that station than any other station I have ever been on in the RAF. We knew each other. We knew each other's fads and foibles. If a man was depressed, another man would soon fetch him out of it by taking him out, making him play a game or something of that sort. And morale was terribly high. I can't think of any individual case. Whilst I was there, two or three people died of sunstroke. Some people made rather a hash of things and some were suffering mentally, but they were very, very few. And since it was a man-only camp, there were one or two cases of sodomy. But this was to be expected. And as soon as a man was caught, he was sent home. It was not condoned. But it taught a man to be a man. There's no doubt, because you had to put up with the weather, the climate, the loneliness, and the fact that you were working hard. This, I suppose, was a good thing. The station commander wouldn't let people laze around and do nothing. He insisted that they either be working or playing, and that's why we had a wonderful sporting record.
How did you get on with the local population in Iraq?
Very well indeed. The station was made secure by what we called levies. These were locally enlisted personnel who guarded the station in a variety of dress, no known uniform. They just wore a hat, an aigle and galabeer, and an armband that showed them to be levies. The little village of Zubair nearby, about 3 miles away, we could go in there at any time of day or night and know we were perfectly safe. It was a filthy, unhygienic, typical Arab town. Yet, you could go into a house, be offered food, coffee, and know that it was quite safe. Yes, we were very friendly. We weren't accepted as such that we were a force, a military force at all. We were accepted as human beings, fellow human beings.
So were you regarded as an occupying force?
No. Oh, no, no. Not an occupying force at all, no. No, they had their own rules, regulations. They lived by those. We were just there. We were a source of income to them. And I think this probably swayed the way of things.
You mentioned the levies. Were these the Iraq levies?
Iraq levies, yes. They had an English officer, but they were all locally enlisted personnel. A semi-military force.
You mentioned the Arab servants. How did they perform their work?
In typically Arab fashion, slapdash. But then they were paid so little. I can't remember the actual figure. We worked then in, they were deaners and mills. I probably paid less than 10 shillings a month. And for that, I would have my bed made up, I would have all my laundry done, all my repairs, all my errands run. And that is as an airman. We used to have share one bearer among four. One bearer to every four men. They were very good, they were very loyal. And reasonably honest. The odd thing disappeared. But, for instance, in the winter, they would go out and buy you fruit and grapes in the village, that sort of thing. In the summer, you always slept outside at night. Your bed was outside with a mosquito net on. They would take your bed out and prepare it. we all had pets, either a praying mantis or a chameleon, which we kept inside the mosquito net to keep the odd fly down. They would feed those for us. I kept pigeons as well. I started with two and I finished up with 120 pigeons.
Because they bred, you mean?
They bred so rapidly, yes.
You said that the servants were reasonably honest. Were the airmen honest to the servants? Did they pay them their dues?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were quite fair. Because there was always a way that the bearer could get back on them. They would forget to polish a pair of boots or slit a sheet in the bed or something like that. They had their little knacks.
How did you come to leave Iraq?
At the end of my tour, you were only allowed to serve a maximum of 2.5 years in Iraq because of the climatic conditions. And the tour overseas was for 5 years. So I was then moved on to India. Some people went straight to India from UK and served 5 years. But I spent my first 2.5 in Iraq and then was moved on to India to serve a further 2.5 years.
Where were you stationed in India?
I first went to Karachi, to what was known as the aircraft depot, Dwig Road, where I was again employed on main station as wireless operator. And also, by reason of my experience as a wireless operator air gunner with 84 Squadron, I was allowed to fly with the aircraft in the depot after they had been rebuilt in order to test the radios before the aircraft were dispersed to various squadrons throughout India. At the depot, they would take an aircraft, a Wapiti, a Hart, Audax, and completely strip it, every nut and bolt, right down to the bare fuselage, and then rebuild it and send it back to the squadrons. So, of course, these needed air testing after completion. And local pilots flew them, and I or another person would test the radios. So I had an interesting job there, main station and flying as well.
How did you said it was interesting work. How did you like being at Dwig Road?
It was interesting in that we saw a lot of people passing through. It was a transit airfield. Civilian aircraft used it a lot, so we would see different people. Something we'd missed in Iraq. The constant movement of aircraft meant that we'd see old faces, old friends that would be passing through. It was also a very large station with a very large married content as well, so that the social life was pretty high. And Karachi itself was an interesting town. There was good swimming, there was good fishing to be had there, cinemas. It was so different from Shaiba.